Teal versus Rosette, are you ready to proceed?
Good morning, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs. Ray DiCamillo for defendants, appellees. I'd like to begin by introducing my colleagues at council table. Sean Carnathan from the law firm of O'Connor, Carnathan & Mack in Massachusetts, and my colleague Michael Robinson from my office. Mr. Carnathan has been admitted pro hoc vice and, with the court's permission, will be presenting argument on behalf of the defendants this morning.
Thank you. Welcome to the court. Good morning, Mr. Jenkins.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, David Jenkins for plaintiffs below, appellants here. Before I begin, I'd like to introduce to the Court Michelle Gott from my office and John Reed from Edwards Angel Palmer & Dodge, who is our co-counsel.
Good morning.
This, of course, is an interlocutory appeal from the Court of Chancery, and we appreciate the Court's willingness to hear this appeal on an interlocutory basis. Although the statement of facts in our briefs was fairly long, I think the highlights can be set forth fairly quickly. Single Point was a startup financial services company. It had had financial problems for several years before the transactions at issue. However, by the beginning of the year 2000, the critical year in this case, there were certain signs that the company was going to improve in the future. Probably not coincidentally, right at that time, in 2000, the chief defendant, Mr. Rosette, schemed to take for himself essentially all the equity in the company. He did so in an interested transaction. There were only two members of the board of directors. He was one of them. Therefore, it's an interested transaction. The first transaction, the only one before this court, is the debt conversion that occurred in March of 2000. In that transaction, the board of directors ignored Mr. Rosette's contractual requirement to exchange debt for stock, should he wish to do so, at 50 cents per share, and allowed him to do so at 5 cents a share. The resulting dilution was enormous and material. Not only did they do this, they kept the conversion a secret. They did not tell the stockholders that this conversion had occurred, although they sought stockholder approval, as was required, to increase the number of shares of the company. They never told the stockholders why. In the information statement in connection with the merger that occurred later in 2000, although they told the stockholders that a debt conversion had occurred, they did not tell the stockholders how much or at what rate, which are the two critical issues here. Thus, when the merger with Cofinity occurred in October of 2000, Mr. Rosette was able to take for himself virtually all of the consideration in the merger. Had the dilution not occurred, the improper dilution in March not occurred, the stockholders we represent, who are minority stockholders in the company, would have received about five times as much consideration in the merger as they actually did. This lawsuit resulted. Of course, below, the Court of Chancery ruled against us in connection with the stock dilution in March, holding that it was a derivative claim instead of a direct claim. Everything else in the case on which the defendants moved for summary judgment was denied. So we're here on only one issue. The Court of Chancery thought it was best to determine, have both issues tried at the same time. That is, if this court determines that the stock dilution claim is direct and not derivative, it is far more efficient to have it to do those at the same time. We believe we have two bases under which to overturn this Court of Chancery's decision. The first is under Tooley versus Donaldson, Lufkin, Jeanrette, and the second is under TriStar Pictures. Let me start with Tooley. The standard is by now well known. Both the Court of Chancery and this court is required to focus on who suffered the alleged harm and who would receive the benefit of any recovery. The Court of Chancery, of course, found that in this case, with respect to the March stock dilution, it would be the company that suffered the harm and the company that would obtain the benefit of any recovery. With respect, we disagree. It was the stockholders who suffered the real damages here, not the company. It was the stockholders who suffered a reduced piece of the company's pie, to put it another way. At the time, if the merger with Cofinity had occurred only several days or several weeks after the March stock dilution, we think it is clear from the record that Cofinity would not have cared who was receiving the consideration of the merger. That is, Cofinity would not have paid less for the company as a result of what Mr. Rosette did in March. The company, therefore, would have suffered no damages. But our clients, the minority stockholders, clearly suffered here. Their portion of the company was reduced. They got nothing back in return, and therefore, when the merger occurred, they lost substantially.
Is it your position that as an economic matter, if, let's assume, stock is sold to a third party for less than fair value, that in all those cases, no matter what the consideration, the company is not affected? That is, there's no harm to the company?
No, Your Honor. We do not need to go that far. We don't take that position.
If you don't need to go that far, what distinguishes this case from that hypothetical?
Because in this case, Your Honor, there is no showing below, and we don't believe there can be a showing, that the company was actually harmed by the issuance of stock. The defendants, both below and in their briefs, point to various, it's largely law review articles, saying that stock can be considered an asset of the company, and that at least in certain circumstances, if stock can be, if the company has sold stock for too little, it can be considered a company claim and therefore a derivative claim. Here, there's no such showing. The company was in clear financial trouble as of March 2000. Nobody disputes that. It was not in a situation in which it could have sold the stock on the marketplace. There was one other potential purchaser, Standard & Poor's, but there was plenty of stock left over. If the stock that was given to Mr. Rossetti as a result of the debt conversion cost the company nothing, they were never in a situation in which they would be unable to sell additional stock on the market, so the company lost nothing as a result.
But how does this case differ from any other case where the company is selling stock? I mean, you could make that statement about any sale of stock in an effort to raise capital, that the stock costs the company nothing.
I think in other cases, Your Honor, would not occur. If the company was a publicly traded company, stock sold in the marketplace, giving away stock for too little would prevent it from selling the additional stock at a higher price. So I think this company's situation is unusual because of the lack of potential buyers out there.
And that's because of what?
Because of the financial situation the company found itself in March of 2000.
Was the company insolvent? Is that the bright line differentiation?
The defendants have repeatedly said the company was insolvent, and certainly under the ability to pay your debts on an ongoing basis, the company was insolvent. It could not pay its debts on an ongoing basis without infusions of money from Mr. Rossetti.
If we were to accept your argument, we would have to do so on a principled basis. And I'm searching for the principle that would distinguish this case, that is, that would enable us to say that in this case the company wasn't harmed, but in other cases it would be under the same facts.
Under the same facts?
Well, in the same transaction.
I've attempted to do so. The principal basis that we see, Your Honor, is that here the company did not lose out when it gave the stock to Mr. Rossetti. That is, there was not another entity to whom it could have sold that stock at a substantially higher price. It had sufficient shares of stock to handle the Standard & Poor's transaction had that option gone through. Therefore, there is no evidence that it lost anything. And since it didn't lose anything, I think under Tooley, it's a direct claim and not a derivative claim.
Let's say, if I follow your direct claim,
all right,
they converted the stock at 5 cents when they should have converted it at 50 cents.
Yes,
and
sure.
And your clients are saying that Mr. Rossetti owes them the money that he got during the merger that was really their share of the equity if it would have been converted at the higher rate.
That is the damages that we will seek below, assuming, of course, that this claim is reversed and we get back down below. Yes, Your Honor. Had Mr. Rossetti converted at the proper rate, our clients would have had a substantially greater share of the company at the time of the Cofinity merger and would have, therefore, we believe, had a much greater share of the merger consideration. We think that difference is damages.
Well, one thing the Court of Chancery did was say that the two transactions were unrelated, that the Cofinity transaction wasn't contemplated, but put that aside. It seems that the Court of Chancery viewed it as the company should have gotten 50 cents or converted at 50 cents, it converted at 5 cents, and therefore it's the company's claim based on this contract. And to the extent it's the company's claim, it's a derivative claim, and if the equity is increased by recovering the derivative claim, then everybody benefits indirectly if you're shareholders. Why were they incorrect on that? Why was the Court of Chancery wrong on that?
I think it's easiest to analyze that, Your Honor, by looking at what would have happened, what happens in connection with the merger. Let's cut down the 7 months in between to a couple of days or a couple of weeks, because it, I think it's easier analytically. Had the merger, the debt conversion occurred, as we say it should have, with Mr. Rossetti receiving one-tenth as much stock as he did, and then the Cofinity merger occurred, say a couple of weeks later, just to cut off any intervening facts, there's nothing in the record, and there's no analysis that we can think of that would show that Cofinity would have paid anything separate for the company, anything different for the company. The company's value to Cofinity would have been the same. Under those circumstances, if the company's value would have been the same, the company could not, analytically, have lost anything of value. Therefore, since there's clear dilution here of the minority stockholders, the claim has to be a direct claim because the minority stockholders were hurt.
Well, let's suppose that the merger never occurred. And, you know, we just have this conversion. How do you see it working then? Your clients know it happened. They get knowledge. Here they got it through the merger. But let's suppose they have knowledge of what happened. How you're saying that they then had a direct claim that they could pursue?
Yes, Your Honor, we do. The merger merely points out the damages. It makes the damages easier to see. But the claim should remain the same whether the merger had occurred or not. I think we believe that's the analytically correct way to look at it.
Well, we're using up your time. Comment, if you would, on your argument to the extent it implicates TriStar.
Yes, Your Honor. That is where I had intended to head. We also believe, completely independent of whether we state a claim under Thule, we also believe that we state a claim under TriStar Pictures, which this court, less than 2 months ago, had occasion to talk about in the J.P. Morgan Chase opinion. In TriStar Pictures, this court held that a self-dealing transaction that increased the interest held by a significant stockholder to the detriment of minority stockholders stated a direct claim. We believe that that's what occurred here. Facts in TriStar are very similar to those here. They are a majority stockholder. It was Coca-Cola. Exchanged assets for allegedly excessive TriStar shares. The minority was therefore diluted. Shortly thereafter, 18 months thereafter, TriStar merged with Sony. And the minority stockholders claim they received less in the merger consideration they would have otherwise. That is, in essence, what we're claiming here. This court determined that those facts stated a direct claim. Since TriStar, numerous Court of Chancery cases, which we cite in our brief, have either held or acknowledged the same point. Now, defendants seek to distinguish those cases based on voting rights. They have conceded that a material impact on voting rights would be sufficient to state a direct claim, and we would think that material impact occurred here where the minority was diluted from almost 40% to less than 5%. However, defendants argue, and the Court of Chancery accepted below, that material voting power was not lost here because the minority was already in the minority before conversion. They cite no case to support that distinction, and there's none that we're aware of. Those were certainly not the facts in TriStar. In TriStar, Coca-Cola, through voting agreements, already controlled the company. That was the whole point of the opinion. The Court of Chancery cases on point, the only one that's directly on point is Oliver, and it also was a situation in which the minority stockholders were already in the minority before the alleged dilutive transaction. And from a policy point of view, if the purpose of the TriStar case is to prevent overreaching by significant or controlling stockholders in situations in which they have all the power, you really need that protection when the minority is in a real minority. We do not see a tension between this court's decision in Thule and this court's decision in TriStar. Now, obviously, the special injury test in TriStar has been overcome. We all know that. But we do not see anything in Thule that overturns the holding in TriStar that I just mentioned. Indeed, in J.P. Morgan Chase, which was decided last month, we believe this court acknowledged the continuing validity of TriStar. J.P. Morgan Chase was held under different circumstances. But we read that opinion. Your honors know it better than I do, that this court still views TriStar as being good law and interprets TriStar that in circumstances such as this, that a dilution claim involving a majority or controlling or substantial stockholder in which their interests are increased at the sole loss of minority, that states a direct claim. Let me conclude by picking up a point we made in our briefs. Excuse me just a second. Of the effect if this court affirms the Court of Chancery. The Court of Chancery acknowledged in certifying this interlocutory appeal that as a result of its grant of summary judgment, the delusions claims here would escape judicial review, and indeed, in the argument below, defendants' counsel acknowledged much of the same. That is, because we were not notified of this claim, we knew nothing about the dilution until after the merger, there was no chance to bring a derivative claim. We don't think it was derivative, but we had no chance to bring it anyway. We attempted to bring this claim in the appraisal action and were told, I think correctly, that it's not a derivative claim. You can't value it in the appraisal action. You need to bring it directly. Unless we get a reversal, there's going to be no remedy for the harm that's been suffered by my clients.
Well, what was your theory in the appraisal action, that this right of recovery could be quantified as an asset that should be included?
Yes, Your Honor. Our argument there was the court should determine that our dilution claim was valid and we should be given credit for essentially five times as many shares as we had. The Court of Chancery there determined, no, it's not a derivative claim. This is not a waste claim. It's a stock dilution claim. I cannot value it in the appraisal action, and therefore you have to file a separate action. We actually thought that was the correct result. We raised it in the appraisal case as an abundance of caution just in case we were wrong, because we're not always right when we make these determinations. The Court of Chancery told us we were wrong. We filed a separate case, and now we're in a situation where there is no remedy if the Court of Chancery is correct.
Do you want to reserve the rest of your time?
I do, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. So I've been introduced. My name is Sean Carnathan, and I'm here for the defendants, David Rossetti and Douglas Batchelor. Two sentences to get off my chest. David Rossetti is an honorable man, and he carried this company on his back for years and lost millions of dollars. And there's no merit to these claims. Now, that being said, I understand the standard of review here today requires that the court assume that the dilution claim at least raises a triable issue, and what we're here to decide is whether it is direct or derivative. And plainly our position is that assuming that there's a triable issue here, that Mr. Rossetti did something wrongful by converting his debt at 5 cents a share when he should have converted it at 50 cents a share, that remains a derivative claim. And we're focused solely on the test provided in the Thule case, solely that we focus on who suffered the harm and who's entitled to the remedy, if any. I'm hoping to focus my comments here today. Plainly, the court is familiar with the background. To focus my comments on the points raised in the reply brief, and hopefully by Mr. Jenkins just now. So I'd like to start with the contention that somehow things are different here from the garden variety dilution claim, where one claims that stock or options or warrants were sold to a third party or a substantial shareholder for less than their worth, which is plainly a derivative claim. The appellants concede that, if this were a cash case where Mr. Rossetti had paid less cash for these shares than they were worth, that this would be a derivative claim. I think the court said that pretty much straight out in the recent J.P. Morgan decision, that paying in stock instead of cash does not change the outcome. So they're now looking at some way to make this situation different for this particular company by claiming that the stock was valueless at the time of the transaction. And I would say that they can't have it both ways. In order to have a claim, any claim at all, it has to be that Mr. Rossetti somehow took these shares for less than they were worth, that the 5 cents that he paid was less than they were worth. If he paid what they were worth or more than they were worth because they were worth nothing, then he's done nothing wrong. We have no claim. The whole premise is that he should have converted them at 50 cents a share or perhaps even some greater number, but I think we're all focused on the 50 because he had a contractual right, a right to convert at 50 cents. And I am quick to point out that the record is very clear that this was a right. He had an option to convert them at 50 cents a share. It wasn't an obligation. There was no obligation for Mr. Rossetti to come around and give away his millions of dollars in valid debt for money that he advanced to this company month in and month out. He had no obligation to trade that in for worthless stock. And certainly, he was, I would say, entitled to renegotiate at a time when everyone now agrees that the company is insolvent.
So you're characterizing the agreement as a put on his part, and any time he wanted to convert, it was his call.
That's correct, Your Honor. He had the option to convert at 50 cents a share. And so that, I would say, is the high water mark of what Mr. Rossetti could be accused of taking from the company, is the difference between the 50 cents and the 5 cents. And if that's the case, then I would say that is a derivative claim, because he is accused of having paid less to the company than the shares were worth. And if we put this in the contractual light, it's sort of ironic that the plaintiff's appellants fall back to the contract. Well, they say, he had a contractual obligation to pay 50 cents. Well, if he did, that contract was between himself and the company. And so, again, he's allegedly breaching a duty to the company. The company is what has been harmed.
Well, is that literally possible that this particular claim could be both derivative and direct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it is the case, is it not, that our jurisprudence recognizes that there may be some situations where a claim will have both aspects?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think the Grimes case says straight out that there are situations where you can have both a direct and a derivative claim.
Why isn't this case one of them?
The BU case, the very recent BU case from Vice Chancellor Noble, illustrates the situation very well. Because once again, in the BU case, there was a split. There was both a cash value dilution claim and a voting power dilution claim. And that's what we have here. We have one claim for the voting power dilution and one claim for the cash value dilution. And in the BU case, Vice Chancellor Noble actually parsed it out and said, okay, we've got the one set. We've got the cash value dilution, where it's alleged that the defendants paid too little for the, preferred stock that was convertible. And the allegation was they didn't pay enough for it. And he said, well, that's clearly derivative, because the claim is that they received assets for less than they were worth. And then he looked at the voting power dilution claim separately. And in the BU case, it survived a motion to dismiss based on allegations of material impact on voting power, but then it died on the merits in this more recent decision after trial. Now, in this case, we have undisputed facts, and now focusing on the voting power dilution claim, that Mr. Rossetti held 61-odd% of the voting stock in the corporation before the transaction. And there was no supermajority voting provision. Mr. Rossetti controlled any shareholder vote. If he had converted at 5 cents a share, he would have held approximately 80%, a little bit less than 80. He, again, would have controlled any vote.
Well, the subtext of your argument is that unless there was a shift of control, then there cannot be any voting power dilution within the meaning of TriStar. Is that right?
I'm not going quite that far, Your Honor, but I am saying that there has to be a material shift in the balance of power.
The materiality seems to be equated in your brief with shift of control, that is the power to control. If that's not right, if I've misread that, then tell me what exactly you are arguing. What is the indispensable ingredient that's necessary to constitute materiality and that doesn't encompass this case?
Well, the indispensable element, Your Honor, is that the plaintiffs have had some voting power to lose. It isn't necessarily a shift from majority to minority or a shift in control. It doesn't have to be that. But they have to have been in a position to have some impact on a shareholder vote. And these plaintiffs had none.
Your example about supermajority vote would be if there was a 75% requirement and these people had 30%, and then they'd have a veto. And if their stock was diluted to take them down to 20% so that they really didn't have a veto, then you would agree that would be a direct claim.
In the event that the shift was from the minority to the majority, if it were just a standard issue of stock to a third party, then I would say that that's
if they had a blocking power and that power was taken away because of a dilution, you would agree that that would result in a direct claim.
I believe that's right, Your Honor.
But in this case, even though they didn't have a blocking power, they did have, at the very least, the right to be heard at a shareholders meeting if there was to be a merger.
Yes, Your Honor.
And by elevating his stock ownership level above 90%, that right and whatever would flow from it was taken away. Why isn't that a material shift?
Well, I don't believe that's true on a fact, Your Honor. The short-form merger statute would apply if Mr. Rossetti were a corporation, if he were a parent, and he shifted it above 90%.
All he would need to do is transfer his shares to a wholly owned corporation.
Well, none of that actually happened, Your Honor.
But we're talking about the ability to do certain things.
Well, these decisions do come down to relatively fact-specific distinctions, and in this distinction...
Well, if you eliminate that argument, the what if, is there any other rejoinder that you have to the proposition that the loss of a right to a shareholders meeting, you know, to vote at a shareholders meeting, and the right of judicial review with entire fairness being the standard, is not material?
Well, on the facts here, yes, I do have another rejoinder, Your Honor. I believe that there could be a set of circumstances where there would be a different outcome if Mr. Rossetti were a corporation and that he had, in fact, denied them.
Yeah, I asked you to eliminate that from the hypothetical.
But again, Your Honor, if we move to the undisputed facts and the fact that it never did happen, there never was such a meeting, there never was a transaction in which this...
Well, there never was a blocking power either, but if there had been a blocking power, then the hypothetical right to exercise it would be just as, I guess, as evanescent as the circumstance that I'm posing to you hypothetically.
Well, I think we also raised in our brief the idea that the whole voting power issue is moot. The corporation is gone. It has died. And the BU case actually illustrates pretty well the idea that when one parses out a direct and a derivative claim, the fact that there's a voting power impact is a different remedy than the fact that there might be a derivative claim for a cash dilution impact. And so it's not enough to say, well, gee, my voting rights were theoretically harmed, and that if this had happened, I might have been denied this opportunity. I never was. And now the corporation's gone, and in fact, I don't want a remedy. They say right in their brief they don't want any voting power remedy because the corporation's gone.
How do you square that argument with the proposition that if the stock had been converted at 50 cents a share instead of 5 cents, that in the merger with Cofinity, the shareholders would have received approximately 5 times what they in fact did receive?
Well, the truth is, on the undisputed facts, it didn't quite work out that way, Your Honor, and I also think that there's a serious disconnect between the share dilution in March and this unimagined at the time merger that took place several months later.
Whether it was unimagined at the time or not, if the shareholders had the number of shares that were guaranteed to the company under the contract, under the subject of the suit, whether it was unimagined or not, it did happen, and there would have been real money in the hands of the shareholders, that is, the shareholders other than Mr. Rossetti.
I guess I'd like to respond in two ways, Your Honor. I mean, I think in the first place, I forget which exhibit it is to our brief, but what actually happened is there were a number of other option issues and share issues to employees and whatnot. And so by the time of the merger, Mr. Rossetti only held about 55-odd% of the shares. And in fact, that 96% vote included everybody except the plaintiffs. And so there was really a shift in equity between the time of the share, the debt conversion, and the merger.
And what follows from that? That is, what's the relevance of that response?
Well, it just shows that
the shareholders wouldn't have gotten 5 times as much, only 4 or maybe 3.
Well, it's not. If I can finish the thought, I suppose what I'm working up to is that this whole connection between the share conversion and the idea that there was no change between what the company would have received in this October merger is pure speculation. The October merger might never have happened unless Mr. Rossetti had agreed to convert all of his debt or a large portion of his debt into equity. We're really into a realm of speculation in trying to make this connection.
Well, why should, if we're going to speculate, why should we have to speculate in a way that disfavors the public shareholders? Why are we speculating in a way that would favor Dr. Rossetti?
Why?
In a case where there would be entire fairness review if the matter ever got to that stage.
Well, I think that the merger is being subjected to an entire fairness review, Your Honor. I mean, that's count two in which we were denied summary judgment, and we expect to go back down and go through that process.
Well, maybe I could get at it a slightly different way. It would appear that the financial impact of the allegedly wrongful dilution occurred at the time of the merger, right?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
Then why shouldn't that be part of what's considered in the entire fairness claim with respect to the merger?
I'm sorry. I guess I misheard you and misspoke. I would say that the impact of the share dilution took place at the debt conversion took place at the time of the debt conversion.
Right. I understand that's when it happened. You know, that's when something transpired. But in terms of its impact on the rest of the stockholders, the economic impact occurred at the time of the merger, didn't it?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe we really are speculating to try to connect those two. I mean, isn't that precisely what the court said in Kramer? And the difference between Kramer and Parnes is in the one case, you've got allegedly wrongful acts that take place in advance of a merger. You've got options granted. You've got golden parachutes granted. And then the plaintiffs say, oh, well, we got hurt by those in the merger consideration. And the court said, no, you can't connect those two events. Whereas in the Parnes, the difference was that the CEO was allegedly sticking up the buyer to transfer proceeds directly to him. It's a critical difference.
Well, let me go at it from a different perspective then. Assuming, just for purposes of discussion, that debt conversion transaction was wrongful, okay, what is the remedy?
The remedy would have been to either force Mr. Rossetti to pay the other 45 cents a share to the company that he allegedly should have paid for the stock, or to return the stock that he received in excess of what he was entitled to.
And how was one supposed to affect that remedy if they didn't know about it?
Well, I'm not sure that that's a fair statement on the undisputed facts. I mean, certainly the shareholders did vote to increase the unissued shares from 10 million to 60 million. I mean, surely that put somebody on notice of something. But this sort of brings me around to the concept of the appraisal action that the plaintiffs have made much of, and the idea that the chancellor said that was a derivative action in that the vice chancellor said that was a derivative action in the appraisal action. I don't think that's what he said. I think what he said was that under Cavalier Oil, we don't divvy up shares in the context of an appraisal action. We don't figure out who gets what shares. And so if that claim had been presented in the appraisal action in a different way, if they had said to the vice chancellor, he should have paid 45 cents more a share for these shares, and therefore the company has a claim for however many millions of dollars that adds up to, and that should be added to the enterprise value of the company, I think that would have worked. That might not have worked in their theory of valuation because they were going for a comparable sale valuation.
It's a catch-22, isn't it? That is, the appraisal ruling was that an appraisal, the issue of who's entitled to what number or what percentage of shares is not cognizable. That has to be done in a separate plenary suit. So a separate plenary suit gets brought, and yet because of the same merger that's the subject of an appraisal, that right is cut off.
Well, I think what I'm saying, Your Honor, is first, this is going to be a very rare circumstance. I don't think this is going to happen very often. But I do think that if the claim had been presented in a different way in the appraisal action, it could have been valued as a fiduciary breach of fiduciary duty claim, and it could have been entered, added to the enterprise value. And so in the big picture, what this is going to do is it's going to discourage people from intentionally trying to do some sort of an equity dilution and then do a quick merger to make it go away, because the acquirers will not be very enthusiastic about putting themselves in harm's way to have this claim added into any appraisal action.
You're saying that claim could have been put into the appraisal, it could have been heard in the appraisal case, but it wasn't?
This is actually something I've been thinking about a lot, Your Honors, is about the appraisal action and the presentation of this claim in the appraisal action.
That was the question I asked Mr. Jenkins, and his answer was that it couldn't. But you seem to be suggesting, to the extent you could value this derivative claim and it would constitute an asset, it would be factored into the total value of the company in appraising it.
I think that's right. The problem in the appraisal action in this case was it was presented as a request that the vice chancellor reapportion the shares, that basically he was going to suck back in the shares and figure out, no, you should have had, you know, 1 million shares instead of 90,000. And the vice chancellor correctly refused to do that. There's the Cavalier Oil case says straight out you can't do that. And so that was the right decision. But he definitively does not say it's a derivative claim in the appraisal action. In the footnote, he notes that, well, this is a tough one. It could be direct or derivative, and this could have an impact, and it's conceivable that this claim will die unexamined. He expressly raises that potential, and it's the same vice chancellor that decided this case below. But I do think that in a different context, it could have been presented in a way that would have resulted in some addition to the enterprise value. In this case, this claim could have been heard. Now, the difficulty, and I'm not saying the plaintiffs made a mistake, but they had a different theory at the appraisal action. They were asking the court to value the company based on purportedly comparable sales. And remember, this is in the context of a default hearing after the company goes bankrupt. But so they're showing a purportedly comparable sales. And so even if they had added this number into the appraisal number, I'm not sure it would have mattered at the end of the day.
Well, all it would have done would be to increase the value of the corporation, but that still wouldn't help the plaintiff seeking appraisal if they did not have their proper percentage of that value.
But, right? But isn't that
is an individual claim, is it not?
I don't believe so.
Once the fair value of the entity is determined, then the claimants who seek appraisal recover in proportion to their share of the ownership.
Correct.
And if their share of the ownership has been wrongfully diluted because of some previous transaction, that's not a corporate claim, or else it would be heard in the appraisal, correct?
But if the funds are brought into the company to match what they allegedly lost, then there's no longer a harm. I mean, the idea is they have a smaller piece of a more valuable pie because now the money has been sucked back into the company. If Mr. Rossetti had paid 50 cents a share, then even though their percentage went down, they would have no claim.
Thank you.
I have only 3 points I wish to make to the court. The first two are factual, and I do not think affects what this court intends to do. I just didn't want the record to go unrebutted. Third point is on what happened in the appraisal action, in which I will do something I rarely do and read a direct quote from a case below. The first point is Mr. Carnahan pointed out, going back to the debt conversion, he said, well, Mr. Rossetti was entitled to renegotiate the contract he already had. We have assumed that sooner or later they would come to that point, and now they have. They said what he was doing is a renegotiation. This is not for this court, but I'll say on the record, they're going to have problems with that because the contemporaneous documents show that that was not what Mr. Rossetti was doing. But again, this court doesn't have to reach this issue. The second point that Mr. Carnathan made was that he stated that the merger might not have happened without the debt conversion. Again, I don't think this court has to reach that issue. There is no evidence in the record that supports that, but that's something for the Court of Chancery should we get that far. The third point is what happened in the appraisal action. We certainly thought we were trying to put this in as a derivative claim, and certainly that is what we understood that the Court of Chancery was doing. I will read now briefly from the Court of Chancery's opinion. This was at pages 18 to 19 of our opening brief. I also reject the petitioner's arguments to the extent that they attempt to recharacterize the share dilution claim, that's the debt conversion, as a claim for corporate waste, and thereby have the value of such a derivative claim added into the total enterprise value of Single Point as an asset of the company. He was rejecting that, our attempt. The petitioners cannot escape the rule and policy concerns set forth by the Supreme Court in Cavalier Oil by merely switching the label on what, in essence, is a claim for share dilution. That is what we thought we were doing in the appraisal case. His Honor rejected it, I think correctly, for the reasons we've explained. I have nothing further. Court has any further questions, I will attempt to answer them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement, and we will also take a brief recess.